Are we good to start?
Absolutely.
All right, how are we going to start today?
With coffees.
Sorry.
Perfect time.
Submitted by caffeine. What's your perspective on flow state? Are you big into... To what extent are you rational with how you make a decision versus following the guise of your intuition?
Well, we're recording how it is. Yeah. So sorry, you said what do I think about intuition basically? Yeah, look. Well, so yeah, firstly, I would suggest that the way most people would define intuition is probably not fully accurate. You know, so that says like, oh, you know, it's like a gut instinct, right? You know, this is what it's going to be. I'm not sure in my own exploration if there's any verifiable information to substantiate that. I would suggest that intuition more or less is, you know, subconscious autonomous decision making. And so then I'd say, well, then what is, if that's your intuition, if intuition is ultimately decision making, all decisions are based off of data, and data can be like actual, you know, data, or it can be, you know, lived experience, right? Which is more or less often what happens. Part of the issue with that is if your lived experience is the foundation for autonomous decisions or your intuition in the context of, say, business, well, the quality of your intuitive decisions is going to directly relate to how much lived experience you have. So if we use martial arts as an example, if you've never ever actually had any experience being in or training in a fighting scene, your intuition is really only going to be one of two things, get in or get out, right? The quality or accuracy of that intuition is going to be terrible because your ability to read data, right, subconsciously and autonomously is effectively redundant, right? So when people say like, oh, you know, I just kind of operate on intuition, and a lot of business owners will say, oh, I operate on intuition. It's like, well, in what context? Because if you've got, you know, 15 years experience running your business, well, then, yeah, you probably can run on intuition because your intuition is probably good, right? Yeah. But I think, like most things, people want to say, they want to believe that intuition, like a lot of other, you know, concepts, is kind of like far-reaching and wide. It's like, I am intuitive about everything in my life. It's like, well, you might be, but that doesn't mean that you are accurately intuitive or effective.
Accurately intuitive.
Because, like, you can intuit outcomes and intuit decisions, sure, but are they actually any good? And if you were to perform an objective analysis of decisions you made intuitively over time, are they actually, were they actually positive and useful for your life? But again, most people don't want to like review their decision making impartially, because it's hard, because it normally highlights that even if the decisions were not terrible, they weren't great, you know, more often than not. And especially in business, because it's such a dynamic, like multifactorial game.
Right? So like, especially in something like business, when you were building an enterprise which you could exit for $400 million, with the decision-making process, was it very strategic and rational in how you did it? Or would there be parts where you'd follow the next logical step that inspired you to take? Because at the moment, there's a lot of people talking about follow your passion or follow things that you align with. How much of that is actual practice in your experience?
Firstly, I think, you know, the context just before answering the question properly is like the way that most successful people answer questions about their business journey is in some regards more illustrious than the reality, right? And, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, if you ask a person at the end of a 10-year journey, hey, how did you make your decisions in the first year? Well, they can't actually relate to that anymore. So they might have memory, but we already know that memory isn't necessarily fully reliable, right, all the time. So then you would normally get the answer. It's like, oh, yeah, I was super strategic, you know, this, that, and the other. But that's mostly crap, you know. And so, yeah, for me, like early on, you know, I would say most of the decision-making was I would very much focus on like, well, what's the obvious immediate next step that feels reasonable? Like, so this true, like sort of super practical utility-based, your approach, like, oh, okay, I can kind of see if I'm here and I want to get to there. Yeah, that's what I'll need to do. And then early on in the journey, it's either you or a couple of people. Things do or don't work quite quickly, so the feedback loop is normally pretty rapid. And that rapid feedback loop allows you to learn more, so then you build a bigger base of information to make better decisions upon. Inevitably, what ends up happening along any business journey where people are achieving kind of like moderate or significant outsized success relative to the market is that the need for decision making becomes more long term, right? And that happens for a variety of reasons. You know, one, you're making bigger investment decisions which are multi-year. Early on, they're like multi-day. You know, you're like, oh, let's like run this ad, let's try to do this, let's update this web page. They're quite short. But you know, later on, you've got a team of 30, 50, 100 people. You've got to get them all on the same page. You know, so you have to be thinking about now, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. The investment decisions are bigger. It's like, oh, you're not just getting an office that you're going to rent for 6 months. An office for 100 people might be a five-year lease. You know, so the decisions inherently become longer, longer term. And yeah, by virtue of that, you need to, by definition, become more strategic, like in your decision-making.
And when you say just strategic in your decision-making, how would you go about thinking about the way to think? Because I've listened to a bit of your stuff before, and it's often that people in the journey haven't got an understanding or a framework or a matrix on how to actually go about thinking. Did you develop that? How did your decision-making process develop over time?
Sure, at a high level, the decision-making process changed quite a lot. Like I said before, I would never want to create an inaccurate, you know, an illusion, you know, about the past that was like, oh yeah, you know, all the knowledge I have now, I had on day one, and that's why I won. Like, that would be a blatant lie. I didn't really know anything, you know, when I started. Over time, you know, I think, again, like by necessity, theoretically, the sophistication of your decisions needs, like, improves, you know, over time. And that's through a combination of, like, you know, trial and error, so feedback loop, a little bit of proactive study and, like, professional and personal development, exposure to better people, frankly, who, you know, become a part of your team. So, you know, just to use, like, strategy as an example, and in my experience now, because I spend a lot of time advising other founders now, if you asked 100 founders to define the word strategy, you'd end up with 100 very different definitions. And part of the reason why a lot of like decision-making early on that has less sophistication is because people don't define things. They don't actually say like, we mean this, right? Yeah, when we talk about something. So from a strategy standpoint, just as an example, it's like, well, strategy is really all about a commitment of resources to work to achieve a predefined outcome, right? So in other words, a business has a goal they want to achieve. The goal doesn't achieve itself, that requires work. So once we know what the goal is that we want to achieve, we would then define the work that needs to be done that we believe, based off of all the information that we have available to us and our collective judgment, that work is the most likely work within our risk appetite and budget and skill set to achieve, you know, that outcome. In order to do that work, you need resources. So then it's a deployment of resources. The only aspect that sometimes people miss is overarching or kind of like, you know, cut through point is like, what's the reasoning for that? And I commonly say this to people, I'm like, if you have a strategic plan, like, you still have to convince me, like, convince me that's a good goal, convince me that's the work that's going to get there, convince me that those resources are going to deliver that work, and convince me that the whole thing even makes sense. And as silly as it sounds, you know, the notion of believability-based action, which is a really simplistic concept, but like, you know, how truly believable is this, and how do you determine if it's believable, is so underrated. Like, so underrated. Like, so if you go and talk to a lot of founders who are like, oh, I'm building the next big thing, it's like, I'm going to build the next big Facebook, it's like, well, how believable is that? And they're like, oh, no, what's going to happen? It's like, okay, well, let's just look at the grand scheme of this. In the entire history of commerce ever, over, you know, since the East India Trading Company began several hundred years ago, you're going to tell me that you, as an individual, you're going to be the one to achieve what is arguably one in, I don't know, a billion, maybe more, in terms of how many businesses start and how many become that. Like, how believable is that? So, okay, well, maybe let's strive for something more believable. I'm going to build a good product. I believe you could probably build a good product with enough time and resource. So let's start there. Yeah.
So would you focus on focusing on the next thing that's believable, like build a good product and then build momentum off the back of that, as opposed to shooting huge from the beginning?
Yeah, like, don't get me wrong, I think having big goals and aspirations is, it can be useful and it can be important for the right mindset. And I think this is something that a lot of people kind of, you know, skim over.
When you say right mindset, what do you mean by that?
Well, like, different things are going to motivate different people in different ways. Right? So, you know, some people are really motivated by building, like, by perfectionism. So they have either positive or negative perfectionism. You know, I want to build the best product. I don't care if it makes money. I don't care if we build a great company. I want to build the best product. And then by virtue of that, they're successful. Right? Other people go like, yeah, no, I want to make all the money. I want all the status, the fame, the power. Yeah, so like, I think how you define, yeah, like the big goal or whatever, it's there's not like right or wrong per se. You could categorically say some things are more or less useful and some things are more or less likely, right? But yeah, for your own psychology and your team culture and whatever, like you have to navigate that. But even to something more simplistically, and I'm probably saying this a little prematurely because I haven't resolved all of my own thinking on this yet. I'm still working through it. But people will often, you know, when it comes to this, like back to strategic plan, they go, oh, what's your, you know, vision, mission, purpose? Like yeah. Everyone is, you know, everyone in the space is normally kind of familiar with that. I'm not 100% sure that I think having a vision is a good idea in the sense that, and especially for smaller businesses. And the reason that I say that is that one, most people can't even figure out what it is, right? Two, most people can't even define what the word means and what it should be. Three, even if they can, trying to figure out what their organization's vision is anxiety inducing.
Yeah. Because it's so true. Like even for myself, the more I think about the vision now, there's only so far my depth can go at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And if I breach that depth, then I get that feelings of unknown anxiety. And sometimes what I get caught up with is controlling the external variables to like optimizing your external state to then be in a position where you can produce as best as possible versus being where you are.
Well, just as a provocative question, right? Like at what point in your life has anyone really ever made like a 5 or 10 year goal and achieved it? Like probably less than 1% of people, right? And so when you look at that, it's like, okay, well, and again, like, you know, the gym is always a good example. It's like, oh, okay, cool. I'm skinny guy. I finished high school. I want to be Jack like Arnie. Right. Like, yeah. And then you realize like shortly into that, that's really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I used to be a PT, like I used to say to people, I was like, they're like, oh, I want to lose weight. It's like, okay, well, let's change that goal to, I want to get to the gym regularly. Because if you want to achieve that, you probably want to achieve that first. Right. And so, yeah, like, yeah, going back to the vision, mission, purpose thing, like, I think, like, the vision piece, yeah, certainly can be anxiety-inducing, and I'm not sure it's, like, super practical and useful. And also, as well, in small organizations, in my experience, you know, your vision statements are quite, like, open and broad, esoteric, qualitative, kind of, they're not tactile, right? And that actually results in ambiguity, and it results in reduced accountability, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like, I'd rather say, it's like, well, our company purpose is, so we exist to do this with these people for this reason. Three things we must always, it's this reason, it's this, you know, product or service or whatever, and you know, this audience, that's bringing those three things together as success. And the mission that we are currently on whilst doing those is this one thing. You know, so i.e. company I run at the moment, we've been operating in Australia for 4 or 5 years. The mission was to successfully launch in the UK. So it's like, we know we exist for these reasons with these people. Now we're trying to take that to the UK. No ambiguity, successfully launched. And we have a short definition of what successful, you know, for the launch looks like. That is immediately useful, hyper simple, creates accountability, drives decision-making, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There is no, there's nothing hard to understand about that. And ultimately, and I say this to people all the time, like strategic planning and or any of that strategy stuff, like however you want to frame it, it's just about communications. You do it literally so that other people in your organization know where they're going, what they're doing, and what decisions to make so they can have autonomy. Like that's largely what the function of a, you know, planning documentation and or, you know, workshops are, is to get people on the same page.
On the same page and not having to guess what to do.
Correct. Yeah.
With things like following the person, reason, and the goal, when you were building your company, did that, how much did that evolve over time, or was that always the metric you focused on?
So our organizational purpose at Sweat was to empower women with fitness. And over time, we would add nuance to the definition of empower. We would add nuance to the definition of women, and we would add nuance to the definition of fitness. So a really simplistic example would be women early on was 16 to 25-year-old women who wanted to lose weight. Fitness meant that they wanted to train using high-intensity interval training, 28-minute workouts, largely at home with minimal or no equipment. That was the initial scope. Then we added 25 to 40-year-old women, and we added low impact, we added post-pregnancy, we added yoga, we added Pilates, so we would subtly change over time. But we would always be able to anchor straight back, like our purpose is to empower women with fitness. We are incrementing the definition of that to allow our company to grow, to allow our company to achieve whatever it was that we wanted to achieve. And like even, you know, towards the end of my time there, because we were having like a lot of internal conversations about diversifying into other audiences, you know, men, for example. And we're like, oh, well, like you can be empower everybody with fitness. It's like, you know, so we thought very deeply about ways to achieve this because it came very simple. It's like, okay, well, you want to build this feature in the app or release this new content or get a new trainer. And it's like, how are they empowering somebody in the way that we're not today? In other words, like how is that going to add value to either a new audience or to an existing audience better than we currently do? And that created the basis for like a almost a formulaic discussion, right? Which again, bringing this back to like the whole point is for, you know, comms and accountability, right? Like how do we get everyone on the same page to have a fair, reasonable, rational conversation?
Is the accountability piece very big and important whilst managing staff and growing them?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, you'd be shocked if you saw how many conversations fail because every person thinks this particular word means something slightly different.
Really?
Well, I'll give you a great example. So like, honestly, like no exaggeration, 90% plus of small businesses, and we use small as like less than, I don't know, 10 or 20 mil a year, you know, in revenue. I see 90% or more of them confuse sales and revenue.
Yeah.
So the reporting, is categorically wrong.
And what is that difference?
Well, sales is effectively cash-based accounting. Revenue is effectively accrual-based accounting. So when you receive money versus when you deliver service or value. So like just as a simplistic example, a subscription business has monthly members.
Yeah.
Yeah, they pay $10 a month. They receive the value in that month. So we receive the cash at the beginning of the month. They get the service over the 30 days. That's fine. Easy enough.
Yeah.
Right. But an annual member, $120 a year. We receive $120 cash today, but we only earn $10 in revenue a month for 12 months because we deliver the service monthly, you know, over 12 months. Right. And so something as, you know, as small as that, like you bring in a person who worked at company X, company Y, company Z into one company, and they all did it subtly different. Either in, you know, management reports, for example, like how many things are lost because of that, or CAC, you know, customer acquisition cost, CPA, cost per acquisition. Okay, that's all subtly different from company to company. Yeah, and people make a lot of assumptions, and as a result of that, conversations become largely ineffectual. Like even just blended CAC, organic CAC, paid CAC, what's paid, you know, like these things are all, they're all similar, but they're all subtly different company to company. And it ends up making so much conversation, frankly, useless. Yeah, like it's and very frustrating for the people involved in it, right?
Could imagine. One thing that you touched on then was the idea of having a revenue stream based on subscription.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing in real estate, which we don't have, brokers are a little bit different, but as buyer's agents or selling agents, we don't have that consistent cash flow of like a fixed income unless you do property management.
Yeah.
How important do you think it is for a business to start exploring fixed income streams versus commission based?
I'd probably respond to that by asking a question, which would be like, well, what's the best thing for the business in the context of its market and the models that are present in it? So like, for example, it wouldn't be impossible, but you know, it'd be very hard if you were just a traditional real estate, you know, sell houses for clients, right? Like, you don't have a long-term commercial relationship with those people. You might have a long-term relationship with them, and then maybe they sell a house today, and then they maybe buy another one from you in five years, and then maybe 10 years later, with another one. So yes, you have a long-term relationship, but it's not ongoing commercially, right? And so the subscription as a model is about ongoing perpetual use. That's effectively the thing, and that can ongoing perpetual use can only be derived from ongoing perpetual value, which is why there can be an exchange of ongoing perpetual payment.
Would you folk, from what you've experienced in business, would you recommend people that are starting out in entrepreneurship to focus on perpetual value adding, or would you still focus on things which could be just a one-time transaction?
Depends on the industry. I say this quite a lot, to people that I work with, I always say the answer to most questions in business is it depends. Yeah. And then the responsibility that you have is then to figure out like, what does it depend on? So for example, it's like, should an entrepreneur start out by focusing on a business model? My opinion is no. Right. Because I think if you're starting out, you probably don't know anything about the model anyway. politely. You know, so you'd be better off like finding an area that you either have some knowledge about or you can get some knowledge about, like an industry or a market, find an opportunity in it and then try stuff, right? Because like even, you know, again, like even with the example with Sweat, like a subscription business model was a solution to a problem we had. You know, we started initially out selling ebooks, right? And then we suffered with fraud, scalability, key man risk, exit complexity, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so if we wanted to, you know, when I was thinking about it many years in advance, I'd say, if I want to sell this company, what does it need to look like? How do we get ahead of the curve? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to resolve these problems in advance to increase the probability that we can, you know, get an exit transaction. And that's also like, there's a small nuance in that statement there, increase the probability that we can get an exit. You know, so many people kind of go, oh, I'm going to build my company and sell it. It's like, cool. How often does that actually happen? Like, just because you see a lot of companies exit in the media headlines, that's great. But the media don't publish boring stuff typically because they're incentivized by interest. That's how they make money, advertise, right? So they're not going to say, hey, here's 55,000 companies that failed to exit last year who tried. Like, there's not much utility in publishing that. So even if you were to look at the data, and I'm not 100% sure where you'd get it from, but you know, even just something very simplistic, it wouldn't be super accurate. But total number of companies that started over the last 10 years versus total number of companies that exited that did start over those 10 years, like it's probably not even 0.1% that have sold. And then if you go into the 0.1% that have sold, what percentage of those companies out of 100 of those, what of them were good deals that people actually were glad they did? Like,
would you say you're glad you did your deal?
Yeah, I think, look, I think given the context and scenario of the market at the time, like it was, in reflection, it was objectively the best decision. But like I have, you know,
What about subjectively, emotionally?
Still the best decision. Yeah, I think at the time. But yeah, like as you reflected on those things, I've done quite a lot of different investment deals and been involved in buying some selling a lot of different assets over the last couple of years. And going through that process, there's certain things where, you know, I sold, you know, 10 of these assets. I'm like, oh, shit, I probably could have kept two of those. Yeah, and this is all like the learning part of the like learning and reflection process, right? But I think just to use some simple maths and logic, right, as a fun game, if you have a business that is, let's say you make $10 million a year profit, it's a great business. And let's say someone's offered to pay you 10 times EBITDA or 10 times profit, so they'll buy it from you for $100 million. And this is based on some Australian law and regulations, right? So if you were to then sell that company, deal costs are probably going to be 5%. You know, the company, I'll use round numbers, so you're down to 95. You're going to pay 25% CGT, your capital gains tax, if you are intelligently structured, 50% if you're not, but 25% if you're intelligently structured. So, you know, you're down to sort of 70, 75 mil. Okay. So if you were going to do that, what would then be the goal with the money?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the logical goal would be to invest it so that you can live off it. Okay. Well, you'd need to make about a 15% return every year forever to make $10 million off of that 70 mil. The average portfolio return for venture funds in Australia, like the median, is 15.11%. And it's illiquid. And that's based on book value, not value paid back to investors.
Wow.
So if VCs are barely even achieving that, the probability that you do just through generic investment, right, is not zero, but it's pretty low, right? So you just got rid of an asset that makes you $10 million a year to make less than $10 million a year, pay $20 to $25 million in tax, $5 million in fees, lose probably a huge amount of lifestyle benefits and tax benefits.
And half your hair along the way.
So to that, you know, to that note, does that mean you should never sell a company? No, like absolutely not. That's not the point that I'm making. But the point that I'm making is that there's a lot more nuance and complexity and consideration that needs to be taken into these situations before you kind of like, you know, rush to get the outcome. Now, also, like just in that note there, that's running on the assumption that you get 100% of the money.
Wow. Up front.
Which in my experience, not that it never happens. I only know of a few deals ever that I have had close exposure to that have resulted in 100% cash settlement on completion.
Wow.
Almost zero of them happen that way. Normally it's about 20 or 30%.
And then the rest in drawn funds?
Over time? Yeah. And then out of the remaining money, normally it's a combination of delayed consideration, so delayed money, and slash or contingent consideration, which is performance based.
Yep.
And the performance based consideration, like the, you know, the larger funds that are buying these companies, they're not idiots. So they're going to set those targets at the point. It's like, well, if you achieve them, great, because we've made heaps more money and then you get your money.
Yep.
But if we don't then make all the money that we want, well, then we're not paying you that. And so let's say that doesn't happen. Let's say you don't hit the tiers. So they didn't actually pay 10 times, they paid 5 times or 6 times. So you end up, you don't end up with 70, you end up with 30 or 40.
Wow.
So then if you want to deploy, let's use 40, the bigger number, to make the 10 million.
Gee, good.
Well, you have to do 30% a year now. And so the maths, like, yeah, and again, like, these are not my ideas, just to be clear. You know, this is the Warren Buffetts and the Charlie Mungers of the world. You just have to spend some time reading and thinking about it. But, like, there's a lot of reasons why these guys, like, they're far better at all of this probably than I will ever be. You know, again, it is probabilistically unlikely that I make investments as good as Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
Right? It's probabilistically unlikely that anyone on the planet makes investments consistently as good as he does.
That. So why would somebody that is earning a considerable amount of money
mm-hmm.
each year without the, like you touched on, having to go through a process of exiting,
mm-hmm.
what hypothetically someone like yourself who went through an experience like that,
yeah.
what would you do with the money?
Well, try to find a way not to lose it. Because it depends on what stage of life you're at. If you're 70 years old, you don't want to give the family company to the kids. You know, you sell it and you move it on. You take all the money, you just spend it. Do what you want with it. You know, if you're 28 year old, like I was when I sold, you know, that company, well, it's like, okay, cool. I was like, well, I'm going to spin again. You know, it's like, because I founded 15 companies in my life. Most of them have been terrible. 15. Yeah, most of them have been terrible. One of them has been very good. Wow. A couple of them are doing very well now and maybe a somewhat similar trajectory. As Sweat.
Do you believe you could not replicate Sweat in terms of the actual company, but achieve the same result?
Yeah, I think
like categorically, you can.
Yeah, humbly, I have always viewed Sweat as an amazing part of my career, but it was really my apprenticeship. Like that's the way that I view it, and I say that in essence. And again, this is trying to be reasonable about the situation, you know, in a sense it's like, okay, cool. Well, I did that in 6 or 7 years with no experience. I really enjoy business and the journey. I was 28 years old at the time. So I was like, well, I'm going to work. It would not be unreasonable to think that I'll at least have some success, whether it's as big, bigger, smaller, who knows. Right. But you know, the logic would go, it's like, well, if I was able to achieve that at that time with no knowledge or experience, surely I can do something at least somewhat in the same realm, having now had about 10 years experience.
Yeah. Making that intuition higher, right?
Correct. Yeah, improving my intuition.
So
yeah.
So let's say if we visualize you as a professional business athlete where you've achieved, you've won a premiership, but now you're going to play in the World Cup against you know, the big hitters.
Yeah.
What are you now considering getting outside guidance from mentors, or are you really just going in from yourself? Run me through your decision making process now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look. So I think on the mentoring piece, no different to the intuition thing. I think people simplify that, right? Like a mentor, you know, categorically is someone who probably has experience doing the specific thing you want to achieve, right? Yeah, a coach is someone who, you know, can help like provoke your own learning, just to have some subtle differentiation between the two. So the coach may have not actually done everything you want to do, but they're very experienced in helping you to figure out your own limiting, you know, beliefs or thought processes. So, you know, I've worked with a psychologist for 6 or 7 years now.
7 years?
Yeah, who's, you know, he's like an independently brilliant business person. Hyper academically qualified, you know, in psychology and neuroscience and all the kind of related subject matter fields. And so, like, you know, for me, like, why did I choose, you know, that as opposed to like a traditional business mentor? It's like, well, at the time I didn't really feel like I was lacking business confidence. There's always more to learn, but for me it was more an emotional thing. Like, so how can I learn to emotionally self-regulate better, because better self-regulation will result in better, quicker and more robust decisions. And earlier in my career, that was a bigger problem for me than knowing what's the right data to look at and, you know, what's the right approach here? That was actually part of the easier part for me in my position. You know, getting to the point where I could work with other people and, you know, deal with the frustrations associated with that, that was actually a lot harder for me.
Yeah, right.
So everyone's needs are, yeah, different. So it's like, oh, you know, like, what are your thoughts on mentoring? It's like, well, who are you?
Like what
problems do you have?
Yeah.
So, and then based off the problems that you have or challenges that you have, like, who's the right person? Like, what skill set would they have? Yeah.
So for someone like yourself now, because I can relate to that, where I'd say from my experiences, the more I can be emotionally centered,
mm-hmm.
try and achieve a flow state as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
do things that fill the cup, etc., the better I can be to make this the right decisions and progress.
Yep.
What's the routines you've implemented during the build that got you to where you are, and then the routines now that you've changed, and what would you do differently?
Yeah, so I think the routine is just iterated. There's not like, I wouldn't say like categorically it's, you know, kind of better, worse or otherwise. I think like all skills, and I believe that personal development, professional development, it's a skill. Like you build the skill to develop yourself. That's a skill set that you build by doing it, no different to playing a sport.
Yeah.
You know, business is a skill or a broad set of skills, right, across a variety of different subject matter. I think for me, I've always approached that like as in how do I actually build that skill? And so like during the, you know, my time at Sweat and even businesses, you know, before and kind of during that, you know, early on it was just like, okay, cool, I've just got to study subject matter because I need to find a way to improve. And I was like, okay, cool. That's interesting and useful. Actually, I wonder if I can find a way to figure out like what actually is the important subject matter I need to learn rather than just studying stuff.
Yeah.
So then I got to this notion of understanding the idea of like objective-based learning as opposed to just learning, right? And a lot of people would conflate the two. They'd say, oh, yeah, I'm just reading all these marketing books to get good at marketing. It's like, well, what part of marketing are you trying to get good at? That's like saying you're studying medicine.
Yeah.
Like what part, you know, of it?
It's true because like you go to university, you learn about the four P's of marketing. Where's your Instagram post you've done on Facebook ads or...
Right. Yeah. So, and this is the thing, like, use the same theme as continuing to present itself, right? People don't want to commit to the level of like discipline, responsibility and rigor required to accept that pretty much everything is more complicated than we would like it to be. Like marketing is more complicated than we would like it to be. Content is more complicated than we would like it to be. Data is more complicated than we would like it to be. But it's easier for most of us just to say, oh yeah, yeah, I'm just, you know, just pumping out my content. It's like, well, there's a reason why Joe Rogan's podcast is better than most other people's. And it's not because he's Joe Rogan, because eventually going back in time, he wasn't Joe Rogan at some point. Like, so and this is the thing, people want to simplify because it makes it more explainable that they're not tremendous, that they're not in the 0.01%. It's like, well, you're not there because either you haven't put the time in yet or you don't have the level of discipline required to be there. I can comfortably say, you know what, like from a physical standpoint, I don't think that I would have the level of rigor or interest, you know, to train basketball and the physical characteristics, you know, to train basketball the way that Michael Jordan did. But I can also say that neither did 99.99% of the NBA. That's why he was Michael Jordan. You know, like Warren Buffett in business and, you know, Charlie Munger and a variety of other people, like not many people have the level of discipline that they have. That's why they get the results they get, right?
I want to read you something on that note, a statement to delve deeper on that. The reason you're not achieving the level of success you desire in life is either due to insufficient time or an inability to handle the associated responsibilities.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that, relating to that?
Sure. Well, we speak a little bit about martial arts, so let's use martial arts as an example, right? So, you know, for people who watch the UFC, they'll see a fight and, you know, someone will lose or they'll be losing or whatever, and they'll go, oh, you know, all of the, you know, kind of backseat drivers will sit wherever they are and they go, oh, you know, if I was there, I'd be doing this and, you know, this strategy is going to work and, you know, rah, whatever. It's like, well, why aren't you there? Like, what makes you believe that having no legitimate professional fighting experience, for most people that are making those remarks, that you don't even know what game they're playing?
Yeah.
Like, you're not even... And I mean, I have a very small amount of experience in jiu-jitsu, and I can say the same thing. Like, early on, it's all about moves. Got to learn all these moves. It's like, the moves are redundant. You have to make the assumption that at the higher levels, because the margin of error is less at higher levels, that everyone, you know, knows the same moves and the same techniques, and it's probably has a similar degree of proficiency. So then why does one person win over the other if athletically and technically they're similar? It's like, well, it's decision making. It's a game. It's an invisible game that you can't even comprehend is happening, right? And so if you then bring that over, and to get to that level requires a huge degree of responsibility and discipline, right? If you relate that, you know, to business, and a lot of people go like, oh, yeah, I can't believe that this person did that running that company. That's so stupid. You know, how could they have made that decision? Rah, rah, rah. It's like, well, if you had the interest, you know, and time and level of discipline required, you could have been there. A lot of people will say, oh, this business wasn't successful because of this reason, or it wasn't really me. It was just kind of this or that. It's like, is that true? Or is it uncomfortable for you to admit that maybe you weren't, your skill set wasn't good enough at that time, or you couldn't handle the level of responsibility?
Do you think everyone can be good at business, learn the art to be good at business?
I think everyone can get better than where they are currently. I think maybe just like rephrase your question. Do I think everyone can be an effective business person that, you know, makes them...
Or should they even...
Well, no, they shouldn't. Like, I don't think that every personality type is perfectly made for that. In the same way that everyone's body type is not perfectly made for basketball. And that might be a little bit abrasive, yeah, and contrarian. But, we definitely live at a time in society where, you know, we want to be like overly inclusive, this, that, the other, which I think is lovely, generally speaking. I'm certainly like pro that and in support of that. But I think as it relates to these sorts of things, the idea that you can tell a kid that they can be anything that they want, like that's factually untrue.
Yeah.
Like I would need to be an athletic outlier in almost every possible sense of the word to be a professional basketball. Like I am born from you looking at, you know, historical and probabilistic data, I'm born in the wrong part of the world with the wrong physical attributes, you know, into the wrong culture, the wrong family with the wrong interests and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to achieve that. Is it impossible? No, but it is very close to zero, like purely based on those things, right? So the idea that you can kind of do anything and be anything, unfortunately, is not... And some people look at that as like super cynical, but it's actually quite liberating. Because if you reverse that and go, okay, well, I'm probably not going to, you know, be those things. Like, what things could I actually be that are of interest to me? And what can I now do? If anything, it should actually make your decision-making process easier. But people will then use this as an excuse, coming back to the responsibility thing. It's like, oh, well, I didn't come from a good school and a rich family, so I can't start a business. It's like, well, but the data doesn't suggest that that's a requirement. Like, so like, you can't use the information as a way to get out of accountability. You use it to direct decision making. Yeah.
I know from my experience, like, for example, there are certain traits or paths that have happened to me in life which have caused me to have certain tendencies to want to progress in entrepreneurship. What would you say are the things about your repertoire or your recipe that has contributed to you having the characteristics to succeed?
So from a very young age, like natively, I was always interested in problem solving and business and how things work, you know, really simplistically. And I've always been a believer for quite a long time that, frankly, that's a really unfair advantage I have over a lot of other business people, is that I love business. It's not this business or that business. I just love the machine. I love the game. I am, you know, categorically like fascinated and obsessed with all of it, right? So that's a very big benefit on my part because it's all interesting to me.
So right? Do you get energized from the conversation of it?
Yeah, all of it. Talking about it, the problem solving of it. Like, yeah, and a lot of people go like, oh, I'm just really not that good at marketing, or I'm really good at product. It's really de-energizing. I'm like, cool, I might not be good at things, but it's still super interesting to me.
Yeah.
And that's a real advantage, right, in that regard. But, you know, like outside of that, you know, like I, you know, was brought up in a family where, like basically what I was taught indirectly and directly was that if you did not have money and academic qualifications that you were a worthless human being, like in blunt words, right? And so, you know, for where I was, you know, there was this really interesting dynamic very early on, you know, that played out in my career, which was, okay, well, I went to university, started a double degree in commerce and law, hated it. It was very boring. It was very slow. It seemed quite simplistic. Like I wasn't really, you know, engaged with it at the time. But then I was doing PT and making a few hundred thousand dollars a year at, you know, 19 years old or whatever it was at the time. Which then created this dynamic. It's like, oh, well, if I can make more money than I would otherwise get potentially in my career ever as a, with a commerce and law double degree, and I'm doing it now with an 8-week fitness course, you know, like that made me want to rebel directly against that,
yeah,
you know, philosophy, if you will. So my drive to have financial success and my desire to like rebel against, you know, like that truth, right? Yeah, and do better was definitely a big motivator. But part of the problem for that is that that's a really unsafe motivation, right? Mm. Because then your own self-worth and your energy levels and motivation are directly tied to results,
mm,
right? And so then if you have a bad performing period for whatever reason, then that's like you kind of like you hit rock bottom with that. And I discovered that, you know, a few times early on in the journey. So as my journey went on, you know, and I spent a lot of time, you know, kind of studying and through my personal development journey, I eventually got to a point where like my love of the game became the motivation more than anything else.
How did the that process change? Because a lot of people that I interview get stuck on the destination addiction of, there's a void in their life that they use as a driver. Yeah. Yeah. They achieve, they get on the hamster and they get the feeling of success because they're achieving momentum.
Yeah.
Like yourself, they're identified by it at the time. That goes to shit. They feel like shit. How do you change that?
Yeah, so...
Or is it just getting punched in the face that much? You just say, I've got
to... Yeah, look, in order for an object that is at rest to begin moving, there needs to be some stimulus, right?
You know,
physics 101, right? You know, and I do believe that in like personal development, like in order for there to be some change, there has to be a stimulus. And the stimulus could be proactive reflection. It could be a kick to the head, you know, kind of metaphorically speaking, a variety of different things. But I think for, you know, in the context of the business piece, and at least in my own experience, And in an attempt to try to understand and simplify this notion of like change, because this is all a change in your belief systems, right? Amongst other things. In order for anything to change, like someone actually has to be aware that change could be possible first, and or that it's necessary, right? And this idea, so like, yeah, in this case, in order for someone to like accept and the need for there to be change, let's say in this case, you know, my motivation was to be financially successful early on, in order for me to, you know, get to a point where that could be changed, I need to accept that it's not actually a great idea. And to get to a point where you understand that it's not a great idea, that requires a huge amount of reflection and your introspection, and or, you know, seeking like the consulting and advice of other people who have kind of been there and done that. And so the you know, a lot of the really valuable lessons I learned along the way, that most of our belief systems, in this case, my belief system of, you know, so my self-esteem having a direct relationship to, you know, financial outcomes, was something I learned, you know, much earlier in my life. And the way that I have, you know, I was taught this, and I've always found it very useful, is that that's effectively code in a computer system or a program, in the program of me, the program of Toby. And that code was written 20 plus years ago. Is that code running effectively for where I'm at now based on the needs of my system?
Right? That's a good way of putting it.
And is it a bug?
Yeah.
And so as we debug and diagnose, you know, to continue in the same, you know, kind of metaphor, if we debug and diagnose that process, we go, well, actually, that code was not only inefficient, it's also actually not helping us achieve the goal that we want, which is to enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
Right. And so therefore, okay, well then how would that code need to change? And then that's a...
And how would that code need to change?
Well, so for me, yeah, it's really about like at a particular point in time, well, understanding is like why do I actually even associate money with self-esteem? Like what even is the relationship? Because a lot of people will stop there. They go, oh, interesting. You know, I feel like my motivation and self-worth is directly tied to that. Cool. But what's the next obvious question? Well, what emotion is driving that? Yeah, and so for me, it was fear, right? Yeah, it was for two reasons. You know, one, like fear of not being loved, you know, because that was a way that in my money was looked at in my family. Number one, and two, like fear of safety and security. So, because I left home during year 12 when I was 16, and started living out of home then for quite some time. And so for me, like, there was a direct association, like, quite literally with practical things like place to sleep, food to eat, et cetera, very early in my life. So for me, the association of, like, well, not only does money make you a worthy person, it actually also allows survive. So then, like, in the reflection process that you kind of continue to pull the thread on that, it's like, okay, well, how much money do I need to survive? Let's choose that category first. So you start, like, writing things down or whatever, and you can go, oh, I actually need, like, way less money than I already have. Cool. So that, and that takes a lot of time to, you can rationalize that intellectually, but to emotionally work through that takes some time. And then on the self-esteem side, it's like, okay, well, like, does having any more money or whatever actually make me a better person? Well, why do I even think that? It's like, well, what do I actually fundamentally not like about myself? Well, let's put the money thing to the side. Like, do I even like me?
Powerful question.
And if yes, why? If no, why? If a bit of both, why? You know, like, what actually is the process? And again, like, you know, those questions and that reflective process, like, it is really hard to do that yourself, like, as in just to start that and have that conversation. It's even harder, again, to then, you know, like, verbalize that to somebody else. At the time, it feels like a damn near daunting, impossible task. But again, for me and my makeup, like, psychologically, I would argue one of my, you know, very fortunate and innate superpowers is curiosity. Yeah, and so for me, I tried to use, tried very diligently to use curiosity as a driver to overpower insecurity and avoidance of vulnerability. So I was like, oh shit, this is really uncomfortable. I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to think about this. Like, this is, the more I lean into this, the more it's spiky, the more it hurts, the more I don't like myself. But then I would reposition that as, okay, it's like, well, why? Yeah, and constantly try to pull the layers back on that. And obviously everyone has their own journey, and everyone's journey is unique. Over the last, like, you know, five to 7 years for me, like, I enjoy life more. I am 100 times more effective, probably in pretty much every aspect of my life. I have a far better relationship with myself. I have far better relationships with other people. I have more business success on the measures that I, you know, use. I thoroughly love my relationship with my daughter and with my partner, Rachel. Like, you know, so all of these things are, you know, interesting kind of, like, subjective KPIs. But, like, having gone through that process, all the discomfort associated with that, you know, to continue the business theme, has, like, paid dividends, like, just huge dividends on the other side.
So, because something that I'm personally in the process of now is, like, okay, similar to the process you've done, understand what the survival level of financial security you require, then how do we go about designing the life that, like you said, you feel presently successful in the process of doing?
Yep.
What advice would you give to entrepreneurs, founders, in that process of still figuring that out?
Build. I actually, with a lot of people I work with, I get them to do a personal P&L.
Personal P&L.
So, like, for people listening, personal profit and loss statement, right? Which is a bit of a play on words, but ultimately it's like, if you look at the P&L in a company, it's, you know, income streams, cost of goods sold, maybe OPEX, CAPEX, and then EBITDA, money left over. Excuse me. So from a personal perspective, you might look at that as, yes, stream of income. Then you have, kind of your, what I kind of refer to as, OPEX, which is, like, house, food, like, general life operating expenditure, right? Then you have FunX, which is fun expenditure. So you might want to have a new car every 5 years, and maybe you only want a holiday once a year.
What's your FunX?
Mostly holidays and experiences. Yeah, because I don't really have much value for other stuff. And then that is collectively your life X, right? So your life expense is a combination of, like, what you need to operate your life, what you need to kind of have fun and joy, however you want to frame that up. And then ideally there's some stuff left over. The point of doing that exercise, there's several, but, you know, one of the overarching ones that a lot of people conclude after doing that is that they don't actually need anywhere near as much money as what they thought. Like, I just started working with another guy recently, and he's like, yeah, I reckon I can live for, like, 150K a year, and he already makes multiples of that.
Wow.
And he was just like, that's really interesting. Now, if you want to live in a big city, because that's the way you want to do, and you want to live in an apartment, up a building, this, that, and the other, sure, you have to adjust that. But even if the number is bigger, it's more likely than not, it'll be less than what you you know, less than what you think. And also as well, coming back to the whole accountability thing, if you don't track it, how can you change it? So if you don't even know what it costs you to live, like where do you even, what's the basis for any conversation about if you're winning or losing?
It's true. So let's say you figure out that number. Would you shoot for the number first, or would you figure out a way to design a process that allows you to hit that number whilst enjoying the process? Or is it get to that number and then figure out a way to optimize?
Well, do you need to enjoy the process?
Well, what would you say if based on not enjoying it and then switching to a place of enjoying it?
Yeah, so it's all preferences, right? Yeah. Like, you know, some people, you know, there's a lot of people who work in like M&A and investment banking and whatever, who, you know, their goal is to make, you know, 500K, million bucks a year. And they're going to work for 10 years, 14 to 16 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week, sleep on the office floor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fine for them. And they can intellectually, physically, emotionally handle that, right? There's other people who struggle to work 8 hours a day and they get 3:30-itis and have to have a coffee and all these sorts of things to survive. And it's like, okay. And if that's the way you are and that's the level of discipline and discomfort that you're happy to tolerate, well, calibrate your results, because it's less likely that you work 4 or 5 hours a day forever and endure limited discomfort and achieve outsized results. In the same way that it's less likely that Michael Jordan was training less than all the other people in the NBA.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's this whole notion, and I mean, I don't necessarily like all these anecdotes, but, you know, like the whole like success leaves clues thing is true. Some people misinterpret the clues, but it does, it does leave clues. Yeah. And like, there's a lot of, you know, kind of obvious truths there.
Yeah.
Right.
No, well, it's very true. There's a question that's quite often coming up with a lot of entrepreneurs and founders at the moment, which is, how do we balance trying to do our business thing versus a relationship? Now, something that's I consider is, do I become the man I think I want to be that will attract the right person? Or do I find a person now that I build with? So from your experience having a partner that originally in the process versus you became a man that helped you attract another one, what would your advice be?
Yeah, well, like, firstly, you're positioning the two things against each other, right? So it's like, is it life, relationship, or work? Like, you know, kind of like this. And yeah, is the idea of that imbalance useful? Well, you know, I would argue in the right context with the right goal, it's useless. I think, you know, this notion of like work-life balance, I you know, to strip all that away and kind of cut to the heart of it, it's like, you're not actually happy being who you are, right? So it's like, either you're not happy to have the hard conversation with your partner and say, hey, I'm going for it.
Yeah.
I'm going. This is what I'm doing. And if you can either kind of stay or not, or, you know, you want to be with your partner and you're lying to yourself about how badly you want to win in business or in sport or whatever it is. Well, I you know, I had a guy I've, you know, been a, you know, kind of big brother figure to for probably, I don't know, going on 10 years. Awesome guy. Called me the other day and spoke to him in quite some time because he's moved a long way away. But, you know, he messaged me and calls me up and have a chat. And he's like, oh, you know, I wanted to get some advice from you. And he's like, oh, you know, there's this person, you've been in this relationship for a while. You know, should we get married? I thought I wanted to gone away, come back. Now I'm, you know, not sure how I feel. And I've actually had this conversation with a couple of friends, you know, over the years. And I said to this particular person, I'm like, well, let's start at the absolute, you know, basics here. I'm like, how confident are you that you actually are truly happy in your relationship? Are you being honest with yourself? Like, how confident are you that you're honest with yourself in this conversation? Because a lot of the time you talk to people and they'll make a statement that they believe is socially acceptable. And then you'll kind of pull the thread on that and pull and pull and pull and pull and pull. And they'll kind of go, okay, maybe not. Maybe not actually. And yeah, the same example presents itself in, you know, people who go to the gym and they want to, you know, lose weight, for example. Same thing. You know, they're like, oh, yeah, so I really want to lose weight. Like, it's my number one goal at the moment. It's like, cool. So why'd you eat that? Why don't you train more? You say you want this, but you do that. So you're bullshitting somewhere.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And people don't like that. People don't like the accountability. So cutting right back to the whole like work-life balancing, it's like, well, start from business. Like, what do you really want? In what order? like make a really firm decision about what you want in what order, and then condition your life around you to achieve that. And if that means certain people come or go, well, unfortunately, that's just a part of life. Because if you were going to lose your relationship because your career was more important, it's like, but then you tried to defend that, and then you were willing to lose part of your career for that. Well, you didn't really want your career. And that might sound super binary, but like you have to have some steadfast belief that you want to hold on to. Sure, you can compromise this, that, and the other, but you can't control the other person. You can only control what you're willing to, accept. Or if you're a person who says, I chose my relationship, but then you're like you really regret like not doing X, Y, and Z. It's like, cool, that's on you, man. That's not on anyone else. No one else made that decision. And a lot of people will say, oh, it's really uncomfortable with this. And I was like, yeah, bloody oath it is. Success is uncomfortable. Doing nothing is uncomfortable. Regret is uncomfortable. Having a crap relationship is uncomfortable. Having a good relationship is more uncomfortable than a crap relationship, because it means that you're open and honest more often. And that's uncomfortable. It's really hard. Like, what you think people with the best marriages and the best businesses are comfortable? No. It's substantially more uncomfortable. Like, I mean, I worked with a guy for many years where we're very good friends now, and he was telling me a story. He used to run a business, 28 countries. He was a country manager for 28 countries for this business, right? And it was a very big business, like very, very large. And he was telling me a story about how he went to a board meeting once, and he delivered his report to the board. He was not on the board. He presented to the board for his 28 countries. And long story short, it was like 26 of the countries were on budget and two of them are off by a few percent. So he's presented this plan about how they're going to remediate several percent underperformance in two out of 28 countries. And he's told this great story about, we tried really hard. We spent a lot of effort, energy and time to do this. And the chair of the board has turned around and gone, we reward outcome, not effort.
Straight to the point.
Just bang. And it's like, yeah, like, and that's the level of discomfort you have to be willing to accept and face into if in that context, you want to win. Like, but people forever will want to live in a world where they believe that they can achieve all the things that other people do that they haven't for whatever reason, right? And that they can do it whilst being comfortable and enjoying it. Like, yes, there are certain aspects of the journey. I love business, and there's certain aspects of the journey that I thoroughly love. There are certain aspects of it that I absolutely hate. And if I was not attempting to be disciplined, that I would autonomously avoid until the end of time.
Do you reckon you can have it all if you're willing to take on the discomfort?
Probably not. Like, because it depends how you define all. Like, if you want perfect X, perfect Y, perfect Z, practically that requires X hours. There's only Y hours in a day. That's not necessarily always going to happen. Number one. And number two, that also assumes that life is linear. It's not. Work will require more and less at times. Your relationship will require more and less at times. Your parenting will require more and less at times. Your health will require more or less at times. And then normally the things that people value, their work, their relationship, their family, their health, right? So like, it's not linear. And, I said this earlier in our discussion, like things are almost exclusively more complicated than what people want to accept. But in the acceptance of that things are complicated, there is just like effectively almost unlimited opportunity to achieve whatever it is, you want in certain fields, right? Like, we used the example of like relationships before. It's like having a really good relationship is in some regards harder than having a really shit one. If you want to be a really good parent, it's harder to be a really good parent than to be a crap one. It requires more effort and more consideration. The parents that are in the most, that typically experience the most anxiety and fear with their children are typically the best ones, because they are worried about getting positive outcomes. The parents that are angry and mad at the kids are less concerned about how they're going to turn out and more concerned that they're not doing what they tell them.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow, mate, that's a perspective shift.
Yeah, life is largely about that, right? how do you see the world? Because there is reality the way that it is. Then there's our perception of that. Then there's the emotions that we effectively experience as a result of that perception, and kind of vice versa. There's a bit of an interplay there. And then our behavior and actions that we take subsequent to perceptions, beliefs, and emotions, right? And if you can get to the point in your life where you accept that the way that you see things isn't reality, they are different. Like, you have to at some point in time accept that what you see in the world is not absolute truth. And there's lots of great examples of this in history. 500 years ago, if you were left-handed, you were a witch. that's not true. We just didn't have the information at the time to know that, right?
Yeah.
So, and people had to be open at some point to the fact that their perception or belief about that was not real.
Right. Do you do anything to bridge the gap between your perception and reality? Like, is
Yeah, meditate and write.
Oh, so you do meditation?
Yeah, yeah. I think that the meditation, for me, in my experience, you know, it really has been around seeking, seeking like real time, you know, feedback. So like one of the most notable outcomes for me has been I actually know what I'm feeling when I'm feeling it, which sounds really silly. Like everyone's like, oh, I'm angry, I feel angry. It's like, but how long does it take you to realize that you're angry?
Yeah.
Yeah, when something actually like sets that off. So for me, that's been a really big benefit. And then I think the writing piece, you know, journaling or whatever people call it, has been, you know, quite interesting. I always find when I'm dealing with like really complex emotionally driven situations, you know, I'll write things down and I'll ask myself questions and challenge myself and I'll document it. Normally I type it up and then I'll come back to it in a day or 2 days or 3 days and whatever and kind of see like how I'm looking at the world. And I've always believed that's one of the big benefits of journaling. If you go back 6 months to a point in your life where something really bad was happening and you read it, you just go like, oh man, like you're just really negative. Like, you know, really negative. Like, that's probably an exaggeration, you know, and like you can kind of... And so when you have enough time reflecting on the fact that you're, you know, you're kind of full of crap sometimes. We're all a bit full of crap sometimes. When you kind of get to a point where you spend enough time realizing that, you know, it's quite freeing. You know, like I always use this funny example. There's a really great like meme of this on the internet about men and martial arts, right? And it's like, it's a pie chart. And it's like, you know, the reasons why men think they would win a street fight, right? Yeah. And it's like, you know, 2 or 3% is like, I'm a trained athlete and I've spent the time and effort to develop skills. And it's like 98% is, you know, like, oh man, like, no, I've just got that in me, you know, like, I'm just gonna like rock on or whatever, right? And it's like, that is such a great example because it's so true, because like 98% of the population believe they can navigate a situation, win a fight, you know, whatever it is, just because, oh yeah, 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 cool, I've seen this, you know, rah, rah, whatever. But then when they're actually presented with it, it's game over before it even starts, right? And so if you can get to a point where you accept, actually, I don't have the skills and I'm seeing this probably wrong, et cetera, then you can begin the journey. Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, I've got to be respectful of your time. I could chat for hours.
No worries, man.
But for me, meditation is probably being one of the biggest tools I've implemented that's given me the biggest return on investment.
Yeah.
Over the gym, acquired knowledge.
Yeah.
And material success. How would you say meditation's affected your?
Yeah. Yeah. Look.
Or jiu-jitsu. What's been your thing that's given you the biggest?
I think like different things over time, right? So like I started jiu-jitsu 6 or 7 years ago and at the same time I went snowboarding for the first time. I did them both at the same time. And I effectively jumped out of a helicopter after being on a mountain once. That was the whole thing. But the purpose of doing both of those things was I was about, well, you're 23, 4, 5 years old. And I'd been living a few years where I was just like winning constantly. Yeah, and in the driver's seat constantly, in the power seat constantly. And, you know, there's pros and cons to that. But one of the cons to me was I was like, I'm not losing enough. You know, I'm not in a seat where I'm weak enough.
Wow.
Because I'm like, to me, I was looking at this, I'm like, this is creating what I refer to in business as the Midas touch bias. So anything I do or touch, I will win and be good at. And coming back to that whole pie chart, right? So with jiu-jitsu, so I walk into the gym, first class, there's a 70-kilo guy, the coach. I was about 9,500 kilos at the time. He chokes me unconscious in about 30 seconds. And I was like, cool, I'm in the right spot.
Fuck.
Because like I was physically bigger and stronger by a country mile, but that doesn't work there. And the facts of reality are, no, you will not win, right? And the snowboarding thing, it's like, I spent most of the time on my ass. Yeah, you know, like, because it's easy to watch snowboarding and go, oh, yeah, it looks pretty easy. Yeah, cool, that looks fun. I could probably do that. You know, I'm pretty coordinated. And you go, actually, no, I'm not coordinated at all. I am really bloody uncoordinated. And that, like, emotional experience was priceless. So,
did it give you much, that, like, going into the conditions where you weren't
huge,
Midas touch?
Huge, yeah. And, like, the jiu-jitsu thing as well, specifically, like, and, you know, there's so many parallels between, like, martial arts and business, like, so many. Except the feedback in martial arts and especially jiu-jitsu is arguably more rapid. You know, you're going to win and lose in 6 minutes or less.
Yeah.
Right? Objective. end, sometimes multiple times, you know, 6 minutes, right? And like in business, in jiu-jitsu, you know, the approach to learning and thinking pretty much outvalues everything else, you know, and detail and nuance pretty much outvalues everything else. Yeah, because as I said before, like everyone knows the moves, an armbar, rear naked choke, whatever. Everyone knows those things. Everyone, or at least most people going to the gym, they're physically strong. They're athletic, right? You know, so you win through better decision making, right? And like, so, you know, in the club that I'm at, I assistant coach, you know, bits when I'm there and not traveling, which has been a fascinating experience as well. But even at that, it's like I will go against my coach and I can't even score a point. I'm not even with earshot of getting a point, let alone, you know, winning. And not, and he's probably about 10, 15 kilos when he's lean, he's probably 10 kilos lighter than me. 15 Shit. Kilos lighter. Yeah. And like, so that experience is brilliant because I can go in and be coached arguably in a position of, you know, authority and power. I don't like that, but people would perceive it that way. And I can teach people who are earlier on in their journey and I can spar with them and they won't get anything on me unless I let them get it. But then I can go straight from that 30 seconds later into an experience of somewhere where it's like, I'm not even within earshot of getting an inch, right? And like, I think those sorts of experiences for people, like frankly, I think they're brilliant. It doesn't need to be, you don't have to do martial arts, but like something that is like so challenging and is like, it feels presumably like so out of reach is so emotionally valuable. Like so emotionally valuable. I think it is massively underrated.
Hmm. Well, mate, thank you so much for your time. It was
a
phenomenal podcast. Can I just ask, what would be the one question you have been asked or have asked yourself which impacted you the most? That comes front of mind, if you had to say something.
Yeah, look, I think it probably goes back to something I said earlier. I mean, there's a few variations of this, but it's like, yeah, am I being 100% honest with myself?
Am I being 100% honest?
How confident am I that I'm being 100% honest with myself? And you know, just a couple of like simplistic examples, you know, like it's great if you're making emotional decisions because it tries to bring you back to ground a little bit, you know, let's use jiu-jitsu. You go to a class and you keep getting beaten by this person that you think you should otherwise beat. It's like, were you being honest? They train more than you. They study more than you. They spend more time on it than you. It's like, well, what magical reason is there that you should be, you know, like beating that person, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, it's not some unknown entity, right? You know, like in business, like I would often say a version of it's like, am I doing enough of the right things? Yeah, am I being honest that my focus is in the right spot, or am I focusing on what I want? Because in business, and this is probably another question I would very commonly ask, you know, founders, especially ones that are very money focused, I always say to them, like, well, do you want to be rich or right?
Rich or right?
Because a lot of founders are very, very much focused on like, it's my company. Wow. I'm in the power seat. I'm right. You know, you're wrong. You know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, cool. I'm like, well, which would you rather be? And I normally follow that up by saying, because right now you're going to be neither, right? Because you're focusing so much on being right and your attempt to become rich that one, you won't let go of the fact that you are obviously wrong. And two, by virtue of the fact you're obviously wrong, you're not going to achieve the financial goals you have.
Wow.
So, and that's like, it's a directly really abrasive question to try to get them to let go of the need and desire to be right. And the honesty thing is the same thing. It's like, are you really honest? Like, are you really being 100% honest? You're 100% certain with zero doubt that you're being frank with yourself? Because it's easy to fall into the position where you are on autopilot. That's easy. Being on autopilot is easy.
Mate, that was incredible. I could see
Thanks, man.
It isn't better. Thank you, everyone. That was Toby Pierce. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man. Thanks, man.